Hello and welcome to the New Books and Buddhist Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Scott Mitchell, and today we're going to hell and back. Today we're going to be talking with Brian Cuevas, author of Travels in the Netherworld, Popular Buddhist Narratives of Death and the Afterlife in Tibet. Professor Cuevas is looking at a particular kind of Tibetan Buddhist literature called Delok stories. These are stories about folks who have died, and unfortunately, usually end up going to hell. And while they travel around in the Bardo or in the afterworld, they meet various people, various ghosts and even zombies, and will eventually have their karma judged by the Lord of Death, Yama. All of this after seeing lots of suffering before being sent back here to the land of the living, where they extol the virtues of being a good Buddhist and why it's so important to be a good Buddhist. So as you can imagine, this is rich, exciting literature that's not particularly well known outside of Tibet, but more than just this interesting kind of literature about Tibetan Buddhist cosmology, it also says something about what we might call popular religion and the relationship between popular or common religion and religious practices and the more orthodox doctrinal literature that one finds in Tibetan Buddhism. So, without further ado, let's get to the interview. So today we're talking with Professor Brian Cuevas about his new book, Travels in the Netherworld, Buddhist Popular Narratives of Death and the Afterlife in Tibet. It's a very fascinating book about what might be called popular literature and popular death tales in Tibetan Buddhism and Tibetan religion more generally. And I have had the pleasure of reading it and absorbing it and thinking about the afterlife and all that awaits us. And I'm looking very forward to speaking with Brian today. So welcome, Brian. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Scott. Thank you for the nice words there at the beginning.
This is one of those topics that I secretly really enjoy about Buddhism. You know, we don't talk that much about the hell realms in American context, right. So it's always sort of fun to think about. But before we get into the book, I just wanted to find out a bit more about our guest today and how it is you became interested in Buddhism or Buddhist studies, I mean, and also this particular topic.
Well, okay, that's a long story. Of course, I won't give you the long story, but basically now I'm a historian of religion, a specialist of Buddhist traditions in pre-modern Tibet. I'd been interested in Buddhist ideas and Buddhist languages going back really to my late high school years. Mm-hmm. And I was also interested early on in topics like this one here of death and death-related practices. And I found in Buddhism a really fascinating information about that topic, and so I pursued those directions in my own graduate work and ended up doing work on death and death-related texts and death-related ritual practices, a history of the materials, particularly the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which was what the topic of my first book. And this book is really just an extension of some of those same themes, death and the hell realms and the afterlife and these sorts of, to me, very fascinating and central issues in Buddhism. So in a nutshell, this is, I guess you would say, how I have come to this. Some think of somewhat of a morbid topic, but I actually see it, as I've said before, as a central topic in Buddhism. I think really it is perhaps the most important topic in Buddhism, in all Buddhist traditions, not just the Tibetan ones.
Mm-hmm. It's a sort of central question, the existential question of life and death.
Yeah, definitely. Death and impermanence. I mean, this is what impermanence is, the paradigm of impermanence, you know. So, but what's interesting in this particular material, which I'll say something about here shortly, but Buddhism in all forms, Tibetan Buddhism, Buddhism more generally, promises this sort of mastery and control over death. And Buddhism does this in its ideal of liberation from samsara. It also offers this promise of control through its meditations and the ritual practices and so forth. And it's always been my feeling that this is one of Buddhism's main attractions, really, and has been historically in the different cultural regions, that this promise of control over life's end, you know, mortality and so forth. But sometimes, and you know, most times actually, people don't really have control over their death. You know, they're not masters of death. Even good Buddhists aren't masters of death, and typically are terrified and confused, you know, by the thought of death or by the experience itself. And that's the death I'm most interested in describing in this book, which we could call, I guess, an ordinary death or a non-professional death, maybe even a unmastered death.
Right.
So,
a death with a bit more of a less control, I guess I could say.
That's right. Anyway, it's just such a central topic, death is. But I was not as interested in this particular study in focusing on the masters, the superheroes of the death phenomenon. Specifically, what we're looking at, this Travels in the Netherworld, is it's a book about people that, ordinary people, that die, and they travel, as you mentioned in the beginning, to hell and to other Buddhist realms, usually the negative realms, the scary realms, the anxious, fearful realms. They travel throughout these regions and have all these experiences, and then they come back to life and report those experiences. And those people are called in Tibetan Dalok, and Dalok means literally to pass away and return. And so this book is about these people who die, go to hell, come back to life, and then they report their experiences. And as I had said before, these are people that aren't in control of death. They're not the masters of death. They're the ones that are confused and terrified by the experience. And the stories are actually not always so pleasant, you know.
Right. So for some of our listeners who may not be as familiar with sort of traditional Buddhist cosmology, perhaps we can spend a quick second sort of talking about some of those sort of common Buddhist cosmological features that come up in the stories you're looking at, the literature you're looking at. It's well known that Buddhists believe, or that part of Buddhism is this idea of reincarnation, and that there's these different realms of rebirth. And so if you could sort of situate this literature within that sort of broader context, and then...
Right. Well, yes, it is common knowledge. So we could say perhaps that there are six realms in Buddhism. Sometimes it's enumerated as five. It's extended to six realms in the traditional Buddhist cosmology. The realm of humans that we know well, the realm of gods, and then the demigods, however we want to translate this term, asura, that are fighting with the gods. And then you have your lower realms, the ghost realm, and you have the realm of animals, of course, and then the hells. And I know with my own students that are in my introduction courses to Buddhism, they're often surprised to hear that Buddhism has hell, and not just one hell, but 16 hells, and then 16 hells are surrounded by further hells, right. And it's mind-boggling, and the number of hells, hot and cold hells, and they're excruciating, torturous, painful realms. And students are often surprised to hear about this. They're also they're also surprised to hear about ghosts, that Buddhists believe in ghosts, and that there's an actual cosmological realm that is their own, you know, a ghost realm. The Arhuata is generally translated as the hungry ghosts in Buddhist cosmology. So with this particular literature in Tibet, this Dalok literature, the cosmological framework is certainly situated within that very orthodox Buddhist worldview. And so the Dalok, these ordinary folks who are dying and then traveling to these different realms, they do go down. That's generally the direction. It's rarely do they go up. Now there are cases, and those are not ones that I've focused on in this book, but there are Dalok stories of those who are a little bit more like the masters of death, the more controlled yogis, who do go to all the different realms, the upper realms and so forth. And of course, in the Mahayana literature, you have bodhisattvas going up and down the different realms. The Buddha's great disciple, Moggallana or Moyen, the great story of him traveling to save his mother in hell. You have these stories. But again, those are more the masters of the process. And these Dalok here in Tibet are not that, and they fall. And they fall into the negative, evil, and torturous realms, and usually that's hell. You know, so they go to hell. Yeah, literally.
So the book focuses, as you're saying, on this the figure of the Dalok and the sort of Dalok literature. And one of the things I found really interesting that you do is you sort of profile a few different folks, but they come from a lot of different backgrounds. You know, here you're saying that they're sort of not masters of death. Or professionals, right. So to speak, but right. You do seem to have, you know, a llama, a housewife, and these other characters. So, I, you know, speak to for a second just about the sort of range of characters who show up in this literature.
Okay, well, that actually points to one of my interests in the book, and that is, in broader terms, the book deals with popular religion, or this category, popular Buddhism, and more specifically, it's about popular perceptions, popular attitudes about death and the afterlife. And by popular, though, I try to make this clear throughout the book, I mean common, widely accepted, even public, in some sense. And the reason that I stress the way I'm using this term, popular as common, is that this is runs counter to conventional understanding of the word popular, referring to something, to some independent category like the non-monastic, the folkloric, illiterate or oral, or the non-elite category, the lay category. And that in traditional understandings, the popular then becomes set up over and against or under and against the elite category. And so you have this conventional binary that distorts Buddhism on the ground as it's lived. Mm-hmm. And so that traditional two-tiered model of an elite Buddhism versus a folk Buddhism, let's say, doesn't really tell us much historically about this Buddhist culture, a society and religion, in this case, Tibet. Now, what I'm doing in this book is choosing very specifically four persons, four Dalok, that I analyze their stories. And the four that I choose, as you mentioned, two monks, two men, a monk and a lama, and two women, both lay women, which represents the traditional two-tiered model of male-female or monk versus lay person. And I'm trying to show how this literature can get us to see the blurring of these conventional distinctions, that cut across these social categories. That these are attitudes, these are perceptions, beliefs, maybe we could say, about death and the afterlife that cut across these social categories, monks, laity, nobles, commoners, male, female, and so forth. So I very consciously chose these four characters to get at that, that sense of popular as being common or widely accepted, as sort of cutting across boundaries and so forth.
Right, right. I have to say, I really actually really appreciated that in your comments about popular religion. As somebody who's interested in popular religion and that dichotomy we make between elite Buddhist and all of the, you know, it seems like oftentimes we assume that the elite Buddhists are the more authentic, but it's interesting to see this wide range of people who are influenced by or accept in some terms these very common understandings of Buddhism in the afterlife.
Right, right. And they run counter often to what you might expect. So it's often Well, this is a literature that hasn't been studied very, very much in the field. But you would have this sense that, oh yes, this is the kind of thing that you would expect to find among the lay people, the folk, you know, out in the villages and so forth.
Ghost
but you
stories.
Certainly would, right? Ghost stories. You know, this is superstitious and whatever. But you wouldn't find, say, a monk having this experience, or a lama who is supposedly the elite of the Buddhist world. And so that's what I'm actually, I do have a monk and a lama that are also equally, let's say, confused and terrified by the death experience, you know, when they're not supposed to be, right?
Right, right. They should know better.
Right, exactly, exactly. And but I, you know, I don't actually abandon the usefulness of contrasting dichotomies. I mean, I think it's the way we sort of process information anyway. It's so difficult not to have these binaries.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm trying to do, what I wanted to stress in the book too, is not that okay. That the dichotomies are in and of themselves not problematic. I mean, they can be useful. The key is not to put too fine a point on those distinctions, you know, between elites or monk versus layperson. And worse yet would be to turn those into actual historical categories or actual cultural categories, such that there's a separate culture. There's a monk culture and then there's the lay culture, and they don't have any connection to one another.
Right.
I do suggest a set of contrasting concepts or terms that we might be able to use that do acknowledge that there are distinctions clearly between a monk's life and a layperson's life, but these are terms that can cut across some social categories for us, or some contrasting terms that cut across these typically dichotomized categories. And those are what I've suggested is the idea of a distinction between a religious practitioners. And here it wouldn't necessarily have to be monks, lamas versus laypersons, but what I'm calling a learned practitioner versus an unlettered or someone who may not be that versed in the intellectual tradition or in the textual tradition of Buddhism. Because in Tibet, of course, you can have some very high religious practitioners or religious figures or religious authorities, let's say, that are illiterate, you know. Another set was the formal-informal contrast between religious ideas, the sort of formal understanding of the way the books tell it like it is. This is the way the books tell us it is. And then there's a sort of informal understanding that almost all folks have an informal understanding of some of these, even the most... scholastic of monks, you know, there are some informal understandings of some doctrines that are picked up along the way, maybe in conversations in a village home or at a Dharma lecture or something like this, you know. So anyway, these are some of the issues that are raised on that point that you asked on popular and the reason that I'm focusing on these four characters in the book.
Yeah, well let's follow these characters. Let's travel with them for a second.
Okay.
So walk us through what happens when these characters you point out some commonalities between them, and there's obviously differences as well, but there seems to be a sort of set pattern of these folks who pass away and they travel and so, you know, share with our listeners this some of these stories.
Some of the common elements of the stories are
You know, I'm just thinking the imagery is often very such, you know, visual, wonderful image, you know, dark and frightening, but
right. Well, one thing that I do in terms, excuse me, I'm sorry. One thing that I, these are a rich, literary works and they're actually quite long. So, I had to make a choice when I was looking at all of these, accounts, well, to focus on what I saw to be the sort of key or the heart of what's going on in the experience, and so I did focus on three aspects of the experience that's common to all the Dalok accounts in Tibet, and that's there's a dying experience, of course, and that's usually narrated in really fine detail about their dying experience, well, you know, their sense of their body collapsing and this losing consciousness. They're scared. They always start out getting sick, and they can't figure out why they're ill or that no medicines are working. And they go into great detail about their illness and their experience of the dying process. And so that's one thing. We talk more about that here in a moment. Just lay out the three areas, and the other is the journey itself, the travels of the journey to the hell realms, and also to the intermediate state between death and rebirth, which in Tibetan is called the Pardo. But that and the judgment scene before the Lord of Death, Yama, which is a consistent a motif in all of this literature, in which Yama, the person, will go before the great judge, and all of his or her sins, evil actions, and so forth, their karma is laid out, and there's a balance of good and bad deeds, and then the Yama decides whether they should be sent further down into the hell realms or if they're sent back home. And in the course of this case, they go back home to preach to everyone that you should not be living a bad life. You should be a very good Buddhist because I know what it's like in the hell realms. And then the the third complex of, or the scenario, let's say, is of course the return, and that too is described often in some great detail, and very personal detail, just as the dying experience. These accounts are so personal. This is another thing that's so compelling about them, is that they don't have a generic quality at all about them. Maybe some of the journeys start to become somewhat generic. That's when you get more into the standard Buddhist cosmological material which they're drawing from. And in some of those long journeys, things get somewhat repetitive, or there's a more of a template in place. But where things are really personal are in the dying accounts and in the return accounts. Though that now that I've just said that, I realize that in the journey itself, of course, they're meeting people that they knew in their past, in their previous life, or they run into old grandparents or something like this, or their old teachers, their old lamas or something in the town. But it's really fascinating, I felt, this personal quality, and a real attention to the, what would you say, the fragile sort of psychological or emotional experience of dying, what happens when they die. They die and they usually don't know that they're dead. And so there's a moment where they're trying to figure out why no one is talking to them, no one's asking, or they're asking questions of the people around them, and they're ignoring them, and they get angry because they don't understand why no one's talking to them. And this reminds me of the movie Sixth Sense, which is a great dialogue movie, actually, where Bruce Willis doesn't know he's dead. You know, he's walking around and he's having all this interaction with dead people, but he doesn't know that they're dead or that he's dead. And that's exactly what these stories are like in the beginning. And like I said, it can be kind of creepy and, you know, like a horror movie or something, you know, and I find that very compelling. Anyway, so then they go on their trip, and that is never as you would expect when they go to hell and everything. They're not seeing things there that are very pleasant, they usually encounter people that are, of course, suffering greatly. And these people suffering in hell are pleading with the Dalo to please, you know, report back to my family. And they need to do something, you know, say some prayers on my behalf, or you know, help me out down here. It's terrible, you know, this kind of thing. And then they return, and there's sort of another reference to a kind of movie scene. I mean, it's like a Wizard of Oz kind of moment at the end. They kind of wake up, and the family's around them, and they're like, "Oh my gosh, you're back!" You know. So that's in a nutshell the journey and the what you would find in the book if you opened it and got into it.
And so the character of Yama, the sort of Lord of Death, I find very fascinating. I think there's another sort of popular conception of Buddhism that's sort of non-judgmental. You know, Buddhism is a non-judgmental religion, and here in the midst of the story is this this figure who is judging very harshly.
Right.
Which is just a sort of fascinating turn. So I would love to hear more about Yama, but I'm also just interested in the other characters that show up in these stories. I was just flipping through the book again before we spoke today, and came across a character that I think is probably going to resonate with American audiences, and that is the zombie.
Yeah. Yes.
if you can say some more about some of the sort of supernatural characters that populate right. these spaces. There's the zombies and the demons and dogs and
right.
And, I mean, they just seem rich with symbolism and meaning for the Derlok, but also, you know, I think in terms of Buddhist ideas more generally.
Well, definitely, and this kind of material opens up these issues. One of the issues that in Tibet, zombies, they're called Rolong. Rolong is means literally a standing corpse. And there's a connection to the Indian Vaithala, which has often been strangely translated as vampire. I don't know why that put forward as a translation. But the Vaithala, or the Rolong, the zombie, is pretty much what we think of as a zombie. It's a walking corpse. And the stories of the Rolong, or the zombie, Tibetan zombie, in Tibet, there are several kinds of zombies, and there are two basic types of, or two basic ways that a corpse ends up walking. And is one is that the corpse can be reanimated by ritual means, by using various tantric practices, tantric techniques, some might even say certain types of Buddhist magic.
When the corpse becomes reanimated, it's considered, that person is still considered dead, though, correct? I mean, it's not.
Yeah. They don't do this to a living person. Mm-hmm. You take a corpse usually from the cremation grounds and animate it through these ritual means. And then, just like you have, like with the Haitian notion of the zombie, then that corpse is used for the benefit of the yogi. There are great stories. This is something you find not just in Tibet, but in India and throughout Central Asia, Mongolia, and so forth. The notion that these animated corpses have a certain kind of wish-fulfilling power, and they also are connected to wealth and gold, so that they can be of great benefit to the yogi who animates the dead. Now, that's one kind of zombie. What we're getting more in the Stelok literature, these are people who are dying, and then they're coming back to life. So what happens in those return-from-death scenes, the Dalo comes back to life, but the people around the person think that, wait a minute, this person, this our daughter or our lama here was dead, but now he or she is moving, you know, so there's a fear that they've become zombies. Mm-hmm. And how is that? That's the other type of zombie in Tibetan literature, and that is the zombie that's animated not by yogic means, but by demons, spirits who inhabit or possess the corpse. Whose corpses are vulnerable. Once the consciousness leaves the body, in basic Buddhist terms, the body is an empty shell, and so it's vulnerable to attack. You can inhabit the body. So that's one of these concerns, a fear. In the tradition of these animated corpses, so I get into this in the book as well. Some of these issues of the zombie beliefs in Tibet, and one of the Dalok that I focus on, a woman named Karma Wangsin. She's the case that comes back, and the monk who's watching over her body is terrified that she's become a zombie, you know. And so they have to convince everyone, no, she's back, you know, it's her, it's really her, it's not a zombie. But the issue of ghosts, too, is another thing you had raised. Mm-hmm. But were you saying? Did I cut you off?
No. Go ahead.
Another one of these we call supernatural components of these stories, the ghosts. And here there's a story of the monk Changchub Senge, who is misidentified as a monk, as a ghost. There's a scene in which he is haunting people, and people are thinking he's a ghost, and he doesn't know that he's dead, and you know, all this kind of thing. We had talked about the basic cosmological scheme in Buddhism of the Preta realm and the ghost realm, hungry ghost realm. And usually in those accounts of the hungry ghosts, what you have are ghosts. They're basically just another kind of sentient being that is racked with pain and suffering over a great thirst and desire, craving. But the standard imagery is of the big bellies and the thin necks, and they're not able to get sustenance into their mouths because their mouths are too small, but they're so hungry they have to get more and more, and then, you know, they're called hungry ghosts. But in this case, the ghosts that we experience or that we encounter in the Dalok literature are more of the sort that we might think of in our own culture as ghosts. These are people who can't really leave their their space or their home. They're kind of attached to their monastery cell or to their household, and they kind of stick around, you know. All fascinating stuff from my perspective.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can just imagine a Hollywood producer coming up with some great movies.
Yeah, there you go.
And to get back to the popular religion aspect, it's fascinating to see how these you know, in some cases, literal ghost stories are concerning lamas and the other sort of, as you said, sort of elite kind of, or at least learned aspects of Buddhist culture here.
Yes, exactly.
It is very fascinating. now it seems to me that there's also the issue of the Bardo that you mentioned, and the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and
right.
I know that the Tibetan Book of the Dead is pretty well known now outside of Tibet. How is that different from this Dalok literature?
Well, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, we'll use that title just for ease of communication, even though it's not correct that there is no such title in Tibet. But Tibetan Book of the Dead literature, and my first book's actually the history of this literature in Tibet itself. That literature, despite what the post-English translations of the text have reported, it is a fairly rarefied, advanced literature, and it's not intended. It's liturgical materials, and the texts that are most commonly known as the Tibetan Book of the Dead are actually very high-end meditation manuals. So that's the kind of literature that fits more into that category that I started with, of the mastery and control over death that Buddhism promises.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Tibetan Book of the Dead literature is meant to be used, to be employed. It's really reminders to those who have already mastered or have come close to mastering the death process. And these texts are there as a means of reminding the yogi, the meditator, of what they've experienced during life in preparation for death. And so much of that literature, at least the aspects of the literature that's most popular in America and Europe, is more of this advanced kind of elite material. excuse me now, of course you do have that Tibetan Book of the Dead literature is a vast cycle of liturgical materials. It's not just one book. I mean, it's hundreds of books. And as in any sort of funeral liturgy, tradition, a cycle of funeral liturgies, you have prayers and a whole the mess of things, you know, that are incorporated into the tradition. So in those cases, the prayers and that you would use for ordinary funerals and things like that. Now, the Dalok literature, as we've been talking about here, focus more on the issue of the traveling to another realm, to death, or to hell, or to the intermediate state, the Pardos, without much control, without any sort of ability to change the situation. There's some references in the Dalok literature to some of the more advanced Tibetan Book of the Dead-like instructions that people are used to reading about. But that's by and large not in the Dalok text. This genre of Tibetan Buddhist literature is, I think it would be safe to say, it's a moral literature. It's a fire and brimstone literature. You know, really, it is. I mean, it is a literature that is saying, behave, or else. You know, you must be a good Buddhist. You have to be a virtuous person. If you're not a virtuous, if you're not doing virtues, if you're not accumulating merit, if you're not being compassionate, all this, I'm going to tell you now, you're in trouble. You're going to hell. And I know what it's like. I've been there. And you do not want to be there. Now, that's not really the kind of, that's not necessarily the message you get in the so-called Tibetan Book of the Dead literature. Again, that literature is aimed at more advanced practitioners. And so the goal is clearly one of liberation from samsara or Buddhahood, some great soteriological accomplishment, you know. This literature is not at all about liberation from samsara or Buddhahood or any of these grand goals. It really is about living a virtuous life.
And this literature then, how do I avoid going to hell? I guess this is the basic question here.
Well, you follow the principles of the Buddhist, or the ethical principles of Buddhism, kindness, compassion, of course, also making offerings to the Buddha and to the Dharma, to the monastic community, the Sangha, the whole merit, accumulation of merit, and the merit system of transferring all of your good virtues and blessings for the sake of the suffering of your family or of your friends or of the deceased monks, deceased family, and so forth. And in this regard, the literature is much more closely, this Dalok literature, much more closely aligned with early canonical cycle of text known as the Petavatu, the stories of the departed, which are Pali canon, very popular in Southeast Asia. These literature about the hungry ghosts, the pretas. And that is, those stories, they have some similarity to these accounts, but the where they're almost identical is in their message, their moral message and the merit message that they're put forth, that the dead person is suffering. And the reason they're suffering is because, one, their karma has led to their suffering, but also their family or their friends, usually their family, have not performed the proper rituals and have not given to the monks. So the person suffers. So then they're always asking, please, you know, do the right thing. You know, make offerings to the Sangha, to the monks, on my behalf, you know, so that I don't suffer anymore. And this is age-old Buddhist principle of merit and the value of the accumulation of merit for oneself and for others to alleviate suffering.
Well, that sounds like good advice.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So toward the end of your book, you start talking about storytellers. And it seems as though this, and do correct me if I'm wrong, that there's the connection here between how these stories were part of sort of the lived religion in Tibet, and these folks who would tell these stories, and how these stories got circulated and became, as you say, popular. Who were these storytellers, and how were these stories used? You know, once somebody has this experience of traveling to hell and back, what happens then when they come back and become storytellers?
Right. That is this aftermath, let's say, of the experience in these stories. They come back and they tell their stories, which is what the Yama had told them to do, and what the dead folk that they meet in all the realms say, hey, please tell everyone about my sufferings. And so, yes, indeed, they come back and then they begin to teach. But teach in this case is to relay the moral messages that they had received from Yama and so forth. But the literature itself is actually tied very closely to storytelling traditions in Tibet, as you mentioned there. And this is indeed how the literature spread and developed wide popularity. There are and continue to be traditions of wandering Dharma teachers or Dharma storytellers that often carry with them paintings, the scrolls, or tankas, painted scrolls of the six realms, for instance, or of episodes from various epic traditions, or these sorts of things. And then they use the scrolls and opportunities as they wander through the streets and through the villages to teach, and in return for their teaching and telling good stories, the people give them money and so forth like that.
And sometimes these teachers are not, these are both lay persons and they learned the monastics, correct?
Well, that's where you start to do see a distinction that, going back to those dichotomies, it isn't monks generally that are going to be wandering around telling the stories. Now lamas are one of these nebulous categories, really, in Tibet. I mean, because you can have celibate and non-celibate. They can be monks, but they're not monks. That's one of these, sort of, much like in Japan. These we could call maybe spiritual authorities of some sort. These storytellers are generally not recognized as authorities in some institutional sense. They would be minstrels, in maybe terms we might know from our own cultures. But they serve very important purposes in traditional Tibetan culture. Not only would they tell stories, moral tales, like you get these Dalok, they would tell the Dalok stories, or they would point out the different realms of the Buddhist cosmology and explain how karma works and so forth, and how you don't want to end up in the hell realms and, you know, this sort of thing. But they also told tales of heroes, epic warriors, and other great Buddhist figures, Milarepa or some of these great saints, Tibetan saints. And so this was a very important component of the society, and also very specifically about the Dalok literature. It was one way in which this stuff was being disseminated and distributed. And
It seems like the mechanics almost of how religious ideas become common knowledge,
yeah,
or popular.
Yeah. A certain sort. We could use even the term evangelism in here. I mean, it's a kind of evangelistic, and I actually sort of describe some of this sort of evangelist movements that you get in Tibet, beginning in the 12th, 13th century. That is and in this sense, it's a form of preaching that popularizes the Dharma and gets the word out, right, to to all the villages and all the people, and in emotional ways, and in ways that are much more compelling to these folks than some high-end theoretical or philosophical doctrine, you know, which they wouldn't be introduced to anyway. I mean, that only took place in very rarefied compartments in a monastery, you know. So
it definitely sounds like evangelizing, you know, proselytizing.
Yeah.
You know, be a good Buddhist or else.
Yeah, definitely. And there is an aspect of Buddhism which is missionizing in that way. Mm-hmm. It's one of the reasons that I believe that it has been successful and has been able to make roots in so many different cultural environments over the centuries. You know, it's done a good job of getting the message across, you know, in ways that are familiar and palpable to the people, you know, and chance. They're like, oh, yes, that's like what we've always believed. Yeah, but this is so much better. Yeah, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, it's fascinating stuff, and I think well worth the read for our listeners to pick this book up and find out more about the netherworld and you know how you can avoid it, I suppose. We're coming up to our time here, and I'll get around to asking our final traditional question here on the show, and that is what are you working on now? What can we expect from you to follow up here after we go to hell and back?
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's been some time. I've left the hell realms. I've moved away from the death and other morbid topics. But these days, I'm currently working on several projects. But the main focus of these projects are on magic and sorcery, Buddhist sorcery and ritual magic. And I'm particularly focusing on the political uses of Tibetan Buddhist ritual magic sorcery in the centuries that led up to the establishment of the office of Dalai Lama in the 17th century. Hmm. So I'm focusing here on the history of Tibetan Buddhist sorcery, the category. Can we speak in those terms? One, I want to get into the issues of whether we can reevaluate this category, which is now sort of out of fashion for good reason, but maybe not. I mean, they'll reassess this category of magic as a useful analytical term. How would we describe this? But even whatever terms we would use, there's this sort of ritual of political action, aggressive ritual that's aimed at silencing your enemies or establishing political power. And it's a very important component of the Tibetan history, Tibetan Buddhist history. And certainly is at the heart of the formation of the centralized Tibetan state in the 17th century, and the fifth Dalai Lama of the 17th century, very influential to the great fifth, was involved in these sorts of rituals quite pervasively in dealing with perceived enemies of the government. And so I'm looking into this, also focusing on some of the history of some of the main practitioners, some of the great sorcerers, Buddhist sorcerers of Tibet. One in particular who I'm now working on a translation of a very controversial biography of an 11th century Buddhist sorcerer named Ra Lotsawa. So that hopefully will be coming out in the next few years. So this is what I'm working on now. It's like I say, I guess there's some connections to our, there's still a little bit of a dark streak in that.
Well, I mean, you know, it sounds like fascinating, you know, extra history that we don't often hear about. You know, everyone knows the Dalai Lama and you know, but I think many people don't really know the full history of Tibet, and to know that history from this side of ritual or magic is
right.
Important, fascinating stuff. Looking forward to
it. Yeah. Well, thank you. And you have to be careful with those terms. You don't want to. Often Tibet has always been the paradigm in a negative way as the magic realm, you know, or something. Just the flying lamas and these kinds of things. So it's important to be responsible and critically sensitive to the use of some of these terms. There's certainly some cause for reevaluating those terms and maybe bringing some of them back into use for understanding some of these practices, which are, as I said, are pervasive in Tibetan history and actually pervasive throughout much of the northern Buddhist world. I mean, I know in Japan, these kinds of activities are... a lot of literature on that.
Oh yeah, a lot of the, I feel like there's lots of crossover here. There's the storytellers in Japan and many rituals for the state or the empire. So great stuff. Well, thank you again for chatting with us today. I'm highly recommend your book and looking forward to seeing more from you.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity and thank you again and take care, Scott.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the New Books and Buddhist Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Scott Mitchell, and we've been talking with Brian Cuevas, and his new book, Travels in the Netherworld, Buddhist Popular Narratives of Death and the Afterlife in Tibet, which is going to be released in paperback this fall from Oxford University Press. Thanks for listening.